Well, today we are studying the fourth sign in the Gospel of John. Yep, it should be the fourth, if I understand correctly. The fourth sign being the feeding of the multitude. Feeding of the multitude, which you're going to find in John chapter 6, right at the beginning of John chapter 6. And this is a really interesting passage in John, out of all of the passages in John, because so often John focuses on stories that are so different from the synoptics, where this is probably the most parallel passage that John has that shares with the synoptics. It includes some details that are very synoptic-like. So it's going to be interesting, just because of that. It shares a lot of similar information. So I'm going to start off by just reading out of John chapter 6, and we're going to just kind of go over the beginning of the chapter and listen to the story as it comes out. John chapter 6, page 349 in the DHE. It says, "Afterward, Yeshua went out to the other side of the Sea of the Galilee, which is of Tiberias. A large crowd of people followed him because they saw his signs that he had done with the sick. Yeshua went up on the mountain and sat there along with his disciples. The days of Pesach, a festival of the Yehudim, were on the brink of arrival. Yeshua lifted his eyes and saw many people coming to him and said to Philippos, 'Where will we buy bread for them to eat?' But he said this to test him, because he knew what he would do. Philippos answered, 'We would not find enough bread with 200 denarii for each man to eat, to take even a little.' One of his disciples, Andrei, brother of Shimon Petro, said to him, 'Look, a young man is with us who has 5 loaves of barley bread and 2 fish. Although, what are they for so many people?' Yeshua said, 'Command the people to sit on the ground.' There was plenty of green grass in that place. So they sat on the ground, about 5,000 men in number. Yeshua took the loaves of bread, made a bracha, and gave them to his disciples. The disciples gave them to those reclining. They did the same with the fish, as much as their soul craved. When they were satisfied, he said to his disciples, 'Gather the pieces of bread that are left over, so that nothing will be lost.' They gathered it and filled 12 baskets from the pieces of 5 loaves of barley bread left over by those who ate them. When the people saw this sign that Yeshua had done, they said, 'This is truly the prophet that comes to the world.' Yeshua knew that they would come and capture him to make him king, so he escaped once more to the mountain alone." Okay, so that's the story as recorded in John. I want to also take a look at what it says in Mark, because Mark provides a couple of extra details that John omits. So if we look at Mark chapter 6, and starting in verse 32, it's on page 147. Maybe you'll start in verse 30. You get the whole story here. "The Shlichim assembled to Yeshua and told him all that they had done and all that they had taught. He said to them, 'Come, you alone, to a desolate place and rest a little,' because there were so many coming and going, there was no time for them to eat. They went from there in a boat to one of the desolate areas alone, but the crowd saw them leaving and many recognized him. They ran there on foot from all the towns. They passed them and gathered around him. Yeshua went out and saw the great crowd of people, and he felt moved for them, because they were like a flock without a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. As the day faded to darkness, his disciples approached and said, 'Look, this place is desolate, and the day has greatly declined. Send them away and let them go to the settlements and villages around here to buy bread for themselves, for they do not have anything to eat.' He answered and said to them, 'You give them something to eat.' They said to him, 'Shall we go buy bread with 200 denarii to give them something to eat?' He said to them, 'How many loaves of bread do you have? Go look and find out.' They said, 5 and 2 fish. He commanded them to all of them to sit, group by group, separately on the grass, on the green grass. They sat in rows of hundreds and fifties. He took the five loaves of bread and the two fish. He lifted his eyes toward heaven and made a bracha. Then he broke the bread and gave it to his disciples to place it before them, and he divided the two fish for them all. All of them ate and were satisfied. They picked up the 12 baskets full of the pieces of bread as well as of the fish. Those eating the bread were about 5,000 men. So a couple of other details that we learn from Mark. Oh, so there in Mark we can see it, but it's actually clearer in Matthew that what had just happened before this event was the death of Yochanan, the immerser. This was very impactful emotionally on Yeshua. His whole reason for leaving, what his disciples had just told him, was this news about his death. It's not only is it personally very tragic, but it's also tragic on what it symbolizes and signifies for redemption and the process of redemption that's supposed to be unfolding. John suffered, and Yeshua later refers to John's suffering in terms of Elijah. He says they did to him what they pleased, and so that was, I think, Yeshua was mourning not only the loss of a cousin but also the loss of a partner in redemption. So Yeshua goes off to a desolate place to mourn. He's sad. He's feeling probably kind of alone in this process, and he needs some time alone. He needs to let it happen, but nonetheless, he's being followed. He's being pursued by people who are needy and interested in what he has to say. So we have a few details here to piece together from John and Mark, and particularly. So they're on, obviously they're on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. According to John, he's on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. That says the other side of what? I mean, it makes us ask the other side of what? And it might be that it's saying, when it says that, which is of Tiberias, it might be across the sea from Tiberias, and that's about where Bethsaida is. And it was in Luke's version that actually says that they were near a town called Bethsaida. So we learn that they're on a desolate place on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. And in John, we find out that Yeshua went up on a mountain. What qualifies as a mountain in the land of Israel is really more like a hill in the grand scheme of things. So it's a big hill. He didn't climb Mount Everest. He went up on a big hill, and it's a grassy place. That is a fascinating detail that all of the Gospels seem to really draw attention to, the grass that was on that hill. It seems like a strange thing. You might just say it's a literary thing to add those details, but I don't see the Gospels arbitrarily throwing in poetic details. Maybe once in a while they will. I think Mark sometimes will do that, but they all seem to be focused on that detail that there is grass, and that tells us something about the timing of it as well. John says, Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. And so the green grass on the hills isn't an all-year-round thing. So it coincides with that fact that this was in the springtime. Now, I haven't worked out the chronology exactly, but it is interesting to know that the death of John the story of the death of John has a lot of parallels to the story of Purim. I don't know if it happened. Purim, a story of Queen Esther.
Oh.
Think about when Herod's daughter asks for a favor and he answers, what do you want, up to half of my kingdom, and things like that. There's actually numerous parallels to the story, the book of Esther, in that story. So So that's happening just prior. And so there's so now we're now we're looking at Passover coming up. It's worth noting, I think all of you know this, but there are people who read the Gospel of John and they go and they see, oh, it's a feast of the Jews, and it almost sounds like it distances Yeshua from the Jews, as if to say, you know, that he's got his thing, but the Jews have Passover. It's a subconscious thing, I think, that many people read it that way. Why is it often, the Gospel of John often does this, where it has Yeshua speaking to the Jews? I think we get derailed because Yeshua, okay, when we say a Jew, it can mean several different things. But in that time, we had the Roman provinces of Judea, and you had Galilee, Samaria. These were separate Roman areas. And so by those definitions, or by those demarcations, Yeshua was a Galilean, not a Judean. So we want to, why is Passover a feast of the Jews? Well, Jews is, in Greek, Judei, is the people from Judea. It's pertaining to Judea. So Passover is a pilgrimage festival where you go to Judea and to Bethlehem, Jerusalem, to attend. So that's what makes it that. And that might explain the large crowds as well, because prior to the all of the pilgrimage festivals, people would form caravans. They would group together from all the towns into central locations. They'd set up these tent cities, these caravans, and they would travel together for a lot of reasons. One of which is that it's dangerous to travel alone. You've got many different dangers. You've got wild animals. You've got bandits and robbers. You've got Samaritans. I mean, especially if you're going from Galilee to Jerusalem, you're going to avoid going through Samaria. So you're going to go over onto the east bank of the Jordan, go down, and then back across at Jericho to the west. The Samaritans had a relationship with the Jewish people at that time. It's very similar to the Palestinians today. It'd be like cutting through Palestinian territory. It'd be similarly taking your life in your hands. So,
but isn't that where Yeshua and the disciples went by when he talked with the woman at Sychar?
Yeah. Yes, she was a Samaritan woman.
Right. And
so
they must have been going through it.
Yeah. Yeah, that adds the dimension of drama to the story, doesn't it? And that, if you could imagine him talking to a Palestinian woman,
right,
you know, it's a similar situation. Mm-hmm. Or when Yeshua was speaking about the Good Samaritan, the story today would be story of a Palestinian who came and took care of an Israeli.
Wow.
Yeah, very, very, very interesting parallel. And it's also interesting because it's the same actual region that in Samaria that's under that kind of that situation. So that was one of the reasons why they'd all kind of gathered together and form those, and they would sing. Actually, it's recorded in somewhere. I was reading in, I think it was the Talmud. It was talking about how, yeah, it was in the Jerusalem Talmud. It was talking about how they would sing, I was glad when they said to me, let's go to the house of the Lord, as they're heading toward, you know, in their caravans heading up toward Jerusalem. And when they get into Jerusalem, the caravans, you know, the big crowds begin to sing, our legs were standing in your walls, O Jerusalem, and singing the songs of ascent. So it was a beautiful thing. And I like to imagine and see the crowds sort of forming together and, you know, like tributaries into a giant river flowing toward Jerusalem as they're all kind of meeting up in these various junctures on their way. So I'm sure that when you get to the Sea of Galilee, all the Galilean villages would have met together. And when you got to Jericho, that branch would meet up with another branch and so on, and they would head into Jerusalem, and there would be a lot of energy and so on. So that kind of explains why it is that the people couldn't just go home, and why they were in this situation that they needed food to eat. They're not from here. They all had taken off, and now they chased him to the other side of the lake. So another thing that we notice is that he's up on a hill. There's green grass present. It's close to Passover. One detail that John leaves out that we learned from Mark was that it, and we learned it from the others as well, the synoptics as well, is that it was late in the day. So the sun is declining. They all had a different way of saying it. It's starting to get dark. The sun is declining. The sun is going down. And so that's what inspired them to get this done quickly. That it may not have been actually becoming dark, but it was about to, because the sun was hanging low in the sky. Another thing that we gained from the Markan version was that that Yeshua's compassion was really moved for them, and he saw them like a sheep without a shepherd. And I think that's an important piece of information that we're going to take a look at more a little bit later. Of course, we've got lots of numbers going on here. It says there were 5,000 men that were fed. And as we read it, the version in Matthew, it specifically says, besides women and children, which is a strange thing to say. Why not include the men or the women and children in this count? I mean, they also eat, right? So if you're counting to see how big of a miracle it was, it would seem to be a bigger miracle to specify how many women and children. Why not say there were 8,000 or there were 9,000 or however many there were? Even if there weren't that many women and children, even if there was only 1,000, still you'd say a feeding of 6,000. So why are we focusing on this number 5,000? Why are we excluding other people who are eating from this count? There must have been an important reason for that. And I don't like the idea that it's just, well, you know, women aren't as significant or something like that. That doesn't make sense in this context at all. Of course, remember it said there were 200, it would cost 200 denarii, I guess I want to say it that way, the plural of denarius. It would cost that much to feed everybody. A denarius is the equivalent of a worker's wages for working about a day, a laborer's wages. So it's easy math if you just say it's $100. That's roughly how much a denarius is worth. So 200 denarii would be about $20,000. If you're going to try to feed upwards of 5,000 people, you can't necessarily do an easy exchange rate, because things cost different amounts now than they were. But you can see it's somewhere in the tens of thousands of dollars worth. And I would imagine the difficulty, you know, even if they had that money and they were to send they were to go to town, what store do they go to where they say, is there a bakery where they could say, I have here's $20,000, I need bread right now. Yeah, right. I'm sure they were thinking about that difficulty as well. Why, and also then kind of hoping that everybody's going to disperse to their various places where they could go and get food to eat. You'll notice that it was the people were arranged in groups, and this was a detail that again occurs in Mark. Now John mentions the number 5,000. Mark adds this detail that they sat down in groups by hundreds and fifties. Okay, so this is interesting. In Greek it actually says prasie is how it describes the groups. They had them sit down, prasie. So this word in Greek originally refers to garden rows, like of produce in a garden. It's also though the word used to describe military formation. So if you're imagining like just groups of 50s or 100, you know, kind of massing around in various places, that's the wrong mental image, right? Instead, we're seeing people in a formation of rows. In fact, 50s and 100s, rows of 50s and 100s, you can see what's going on. We have 5,000 people, and if they all form in rows of 50s in one direction, they're forming in rows of 100 in the other direction, right? 50 times 100 is 5,000. So we're seeing them arranged like plants in a garden, or like a military formation of this grid of 50 by 100, which is really remarkable, and it's an interesting. I think it's significant, and I'll explain why in a bit. So, of course, another number that we have here is we've got 5 loaves and 2 fish. 5 loaves of bread, 2 fish. It seems to be significant. And then also the number of leftovers that they retrieved was 12 baskets. So 5 loaves, 2 fish, 12 baskets. We might say these numbers are not... This is just there to tell us how big of a miracle it was. And you can read the story of the miracle of the feeding the multitude, and just approach it from that perspective and say, wow, these people needed food. They didn't have it. Yeshua did a miracle. They got food. They got fed. He's awesome. He was able to bring forth this miracle from God, and everybody was fed and was happy, and this is why he's so great. And you can look at it on that level and just be happy about it, and that's fine. But I think there's something much deeper about it, and it seems unlikely to me that the Gospels would focus on these numbers, and that they would be such significant numbers, and that they wouldn't mean something or have some kind of importance that he would want us to understand. In fact, if you look at Matthew 16, Yeshua brings this story up again in another context. Remember that there's not just the feeding of the 5,000, there's actually also another feeding of the 4,000. Both of those, it's not just two tellings of the same story with different details. There were actually two different occasions of a feeding of multitudes. So in Matthew 16, it says, when the disciples reached the other side, they had forgotten to bring any bread. So they were actually kind of in the same place now where they were before, at least in a similar place. Yeshua said to them, watch and beware of the leaven, or the chametz, of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And they began discussing it among themselves and saying, oh, we didn't bring any bread. But Yeshua was aware of this and said, you of little faith, why are you discussing among yourselves the fact that you have no bread? Do you not perceive? Do you not remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many baskets you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many baskets you gathered? How is it that you fail to understand that I did not speak about bread? Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Okay, so that there's some information that we get from that is there's a connection between bread and teaching. But what I find remarkable is that Yeshua doesn't just point out the event of, don't you remember, I can make bread out of nothing. He's not just saying, why are you worried about bread? I can just make bread happen. He actually draws attention to the numbers. And he says, okay, how many loaves did we have left? How many baskets, or how many baskets did we gather at the end of that one? And how many baskets did we gather at the end of that one? As if he's actually trying them to get them to do math, to think about the significance of those numbers. So how many was it? We know that in the feeding of the 5,000 that we just read, it said there were 12 baskets that were recovered. Does anybody know how many baskets are recovered in the feeding of the 4,000? It wasn't 10. Okay, it was 7 loaves. All right, so It was almost, it's amazing how similar the story was, that it would happen again just the same way. In Matthew 15, 32, Yeshua called to his disciples and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. I'm unwilling to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way. And the disciples said to them, where are we to get enough bread in such a desolate place to feed so great a crowd? And Yeshua said to them, how many loaves do you have? Seven. And they said, seven and a few small fish. And directing the crowd to sit down, he took the seven loaves and the fish, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples. The disciples gave them to the crowds, and they all ate and were satisfied, and they took up seven baskets full of the broken pieces left over. And those who ate were 4,000 men, besides women and children. And after sending away the crowds, he got into the boat and went to the region of Magadan. Okay, so there were seven baskets gathered the second time. Some interesting things. Another interesting detail in the story is the way in Mark's version, I think we see it as well. It says, Mark 6:41, it says, taking the five loaves and the two fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples. In some translations, they're bothered. It says literally he looked to heaven, he blessed and took and broke the loaves. So the translations go, he blessed what? Well, he blessed the food. They just add that in. No, and of course, there's no point in blessing the food. Food is already blessed. God, it's doing its job, and so on. But of course, we know that we bless God for the food. In fact, we know what blessing He said. Hamotzi, exactly. Which is very interesting if you think about it. So the blessing Hamotzi comes from Psalm 104. It's very clear. It's literal. It says. Lehotzi lechem min haaretz, like that, right in Psalm 104, and that's the language we got get out of that psalm, which is interesting because does God bring bread out of the earth? He brings grain out of the earth, and we make it into bread. How is it that bread is supposed to be coming out of the earth? We'll talk about that a little bit later too. I'm not going to have much time later if we keep on going at this pace. But okay, so this is all really important information. We've got 12 baskets we gathered up the first time, seven baskets. He looks up to heaven. I was going to say he looks up to heaven, and this may be just the way a certain mannerism that he had, that when he would make a blessing, he would look up to heaven. In fact, this custom does exist. I've heard it referenced in other non-Messianic contexts, where some people will look to heaven when they say the name of God in the blessing. So they'll say Baruch Atah, and they'll look up when they say the name of God. And so I figure that seems like similar to what Yeshua was doing. So I try to do that when I'm saying blessings as well, and I look up to heaven in imitation of Yeshua. Yeshua was adamant that they had to gather up all the leftovers. Why was he so bothered he said, we can't let anything go to waste. He can just generate bread out of nothing. Bread just materializes for him. And now he's worried that they're going to be without bread. Why? That's kind of a strange puzzle, especially. But then when you look in Matthew 12, what happens? They're out in the grain fields. It's Shabbat is coming, and they can't make it quite in on time. They haven't eaten anything all day. And they're just, the disciples are so weak, they got to eat something, and so they're just yanking grains off of stalks of wheat and eating them. They're starving. They're practically really starving, and they know what starving feels like. Why didn't Yeshua just throw out some bread? So Yeshua is worried about we can't let this go to waste. We got to use it, because this is not something that normally just happens. And this actually, I think, speaks to the fact that this was a sign. It was a specific intentional act that doesn't just happen whenever Yeshua wants it to happen. But it was specifically directed by God to occur at that occasion. Oh, well, I'm sure that they... Well, everybody had enough to eat, so all that, those thousands of people were fine. But they must have taken them with them. Maybe they took them on the way. Or maybe there were people in the towns or whatever. But they made sure that somebody ate them, and they didn't let them go to waste. So what makes this a sign? There's a couple of things. Of course, as Pastor Lancaster has said, this occurred in public. There were thousands of witnesses. But there, and you'll notice the reaction of the people in the Gospel of John, they remark at the after seeing all this take place, what did they say? Yes, this is the prophet that comes into the world. That's exactly right. They were really surprised by what happened, and they said, "This is truly the prophet that comes into the world." And he was afraid that they were going to make him king. I don't know if afraid is maybe not the right word, but he was aware of that consideration. A really important piece of information is that there's an expectation that the Messianic Redeemer would do something like this. And this comes partly from Psalm chapter 72. And we can actually see a number of parallels in this psalm to the story. So I encourage you to read the entire psalm. This psalm is it's my favorite psalm in the entire book of Psalms, and it is intensely messianic. It's written by King David for his son Solomon, and then it has that, of course, the son of David is the recipient of this, so it's all about Messiah as well.
72.
Psalm 72, yeah, and this is the psalm that, you know, when we have this song that we like to sing that invokes the name of Yeshua, where we say, Yachos al dal ve'evyon ve'nafshot evyonim Yoshia. He takes pity on the weak and needy and saves the lives of the needy, right? Because that's the psalm that goes with that's the verse that goes with the name Yeshua. If your name happens to be Yeshua or Yehoshua, you know how you say a verse from Psalms at the end of the Amida. That's why we added that, because it's a custom to say a psalm that corresponds to your own name, and it's also common among Hasidim to say the verse that corresponds to the name of their Rebbe at the end of the Amida, because in a way they're invoking his merit and their identification with him, and that's what we're doing. That's the verse that goes with his name, you know, and anyone whose name happens to be Yeshua or Yehoshua, that would be their verse. But it's out of Psalm 72, and it's about how he takes pity on the weak and needy, and you can see him doing that exact thing right now in this story. He has compassion on them. He's moved for them. They all come to him, and they've got ailments. He's healing their ailments, and even though he's going through turmoil himself, he's reaching out to them and providing for their needs. From oppression and violence, he redeems their life and precious is their blood in his sight. And I wonder how many of those people that needed healing, specifically needed healing due to wounds inflicted upon them by the oppressing government, and so on. So it's really, really beautiful what he's doing. It goes on and says, long may he live, may gold of Sheba be given to him, may prayer be made for him continually, and blessings invoked for him all the day. And then there's this verse that the sages take note of. May there be abundance of grain in the land. On the tops of the mountains may it wave. May its fruit be like Lebanon. Okay, so the sages will look at this passage and see it as referring to the abundance of grain that the Messiah will provide. It goes on and it says, and may people blossom in the cities like the grass of the field. May his name endure forever, his fame continue as long as the sun. May people be blessed in him and all nations call him blessed. And it goes on, the psalm continues to go on, and it's intensely messianic from there on. But there's several different things that we're seeing happen. Okay, abundance of grain, or so we're talking about this bread that occurs. tops of the mountains, where are they? They went to the top of a mountain. It says, may people blossom in the cities. And remember how the people are situated in rows? I think that might be similar to what's going on. They're in a garden-like formation, but that's one side of it. And it says, like grass of the field. And so all of the Gospels point out this detail that there's green grass there, and the grass is mentioned as well in Psalm 72. And then it says, may his name endure forever, his fame continue as long as the sun. Okay, so the sun is going down as well. That's another correlation to the verbiage of this psalm. But his fame, in where the ESV translates, may his fame continue, this is a famous passage in the in rabbinic literature. It says, Yinon Shmo. And there's various ways it could be translated. Sometimes it says his fame. Fame literally here is name. May his name continue, right? And then Yinon might be continue. It might be magnified. It could be lots of things. Proliferate or something. The word is Yinon. And the sages see this passage, Yinon Shmo, and they say, well, that's not just a verb. It's his name. It says his name is Yinon. Yinon is his name. That's the name. Yud Nun Vav Nun, which is interesting in and of itself. This, I believe that the Psalm 72 has a lot to say about the name of Messiah, but one of the names, this is the most repeated passages in rabbinic literature. Everybody says this, that Messiah's name is Yinon. Throughout, it's in the Gemara, or it's in the Talmud, it's in the Midrash, it's all over the place. And in fact, they use it to show that the name of Messiah predates the rest of creation even. So Yinon is a very interesting name. Like I said, it's Yod Nun Vav Nun, very similar to the name of God, and that is not lost on the sages either, which instead of Nuns would then have Hays, and also it's similar to the name of Yeshua, whereas instead of Nuns, it would be Sheen and Ayin. There's still, you have the Yod and Vav. So it's very significant. But then there's something about those Nuns. So I want to point out the parallels between what Yeshua is doing and Moses, because Yeshua is behaving in a way that's similar to Moses. It says in Ecclesiastes Rabbah, or in other words, it's Midrash in Ecclesiastes. It says, Reb Berechiah said in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak, the latter Redeemer, which is referring to Messiah, will be like the first Redeemer, who is Moses. So what does the Torah say about the first Redeemer? The first Redeemer made manna to descend, as it is written, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. In the same way, the latter Redeemer will make manna descend, as it is written, may he be as abundant grain in the land. That's just another translation of the verse that says, may there be an abundance of grain in the land. Okay, so that they're quoting from Psalm 72 to say that just as Moses delivered the manna, so the Messiah too will bring the will cause manna to descend. So it's an expectation that the Messiah is going to come with this abundance of bread, and it's a parallel to Moses. And there's another interesting parallel to Moses. If we look in Numbers chapter 27, verses 15 to 18, Moses is aware that he's not going to be able to bring the Israelites into the land of Israel. And so it's concerning to him. It says, Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who shall go out before them and come in before them, who shall lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be as sheep without a shepherd. So the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua the son of Nun, a man is in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. Okay, so the Gospels are alluding to this passage. Moses sees the people like a sheep without a shepherd, right? And so God says to Moses, appoint Yehoshua bin Nun. Okay, Yehoshua, Joshua shares his name with Yeshua. In fact, Joshua, Yehoshua, is called Yeshua in some of the books. That's the same name. It's just a variation of the same name. And he's, and it's, and of course, this Joshua is the son of Nun. Right? Nun Vav Nun is his name. Right? That's, there's something symbolic here. There's something important here. And what is Joshua's job? To take them out and to bring them in. It actually says that twice. Who shall go out before them, come in before them, who shall lead them out and bring them in. Okay. So there's something going on here. So what is the noon? What are the noons? Here's some so here are some passages that that we need to probably I mentioned them to you before. Sanhedrin 98b, we get some of those passages that talk about the name of Messiah. It says, what is the Messiah's name? The school of Rabbi Yonai says, you known as his name, as it is stated, may his name endure forever, may his name continue, or that is, you known, as long as the Son, and may men bless themselves by him. All right, so that's a quote where they show the name of Messiah as you known. Pesachim 54a, also from the Gemara. The name of Messiah was created before the world was created, as it is written in the chapter discussing the Messiah. It's funny, they call this the chapter discussing the Messiah, Psalm 72. May his name endure forever. His name existed before the sun. That's their translation of Lifnei HaShemesh Yinon Shemo. Before the sun, his name is Yinon. Where is it? What does it say? As long as the sun in the ESV. But it's literally before the sun. Okay. So Yinon, and we have this Bin Nun thing. Here's an interesting fact, that the letter Nun is in the Aramaic, or the word Nun in Aramaic means fish. So how many fish are there at our event? There are two fish. So I think this might be the significance of these two fish. There's a passage in the Torah that has two misplaced noons that are standing out in the middle of nowhere. This,
really?
Yes.
Wow.
They're not just standing out in the middle of nowhere. It's even more bizarre. They're flipped backwards.
Wow.
Yeah, and you can open up the Torah scroll and see them just off, separated off by themselves as if they're a paragraph of their own, just a noon.
Wow.
A backwards noon. So they are bracketing a passage out of the Torah in Numbers chapter 10, verses 35 and 36. These are the verses that we know because we recite them every Shabbat. It says, and whenever the ark set out, Moses said, arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you. And when it rested, he said, return, O Lord, to the 10,000 thousands of Israel.
And so there's a noon.
Yes. Yes, it's a noon that's flipped around.
Wow, that's amazing.
It is. It's really remarkable. It's strange to see it. It's been there since ancient times. So in the Gemara they ask, why are those noons in there? What are they doing? And it sounds like they're not entirely sure, but they have some ideas. It's that ancient. So in Gemara, in Shabbat 115b to 116a, discusses it. It says, apropos the portion and when the ark traveled, the Gemara cites that when the sages taught, that which the sages taught in a Baraita, it is stated, and when the ark traveled, Moses proclaimed, rise up, God, and your enemies will scatter, and those who hate you will flee before you. And the Holy One, blessed is he, made signs in the Torah, that's the backwards noons, for this portion, above and below, that is before and after it, in order to say that it's not in its place, as the previous portion does not discuss the nation's travels. So in other words, those verses are in the wrong spot. They should be somewhere else. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi says, no, it's not for that reason that these signs were inserted. Rather, the signs are there because this portion is considered a book unto itself.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So how many books of the Torah are there? We usually say that there's five, right? However, if those two verses comprise a book of the Torah of their own, then Numbers is actually a trilogy, right? You've got Numbers 1 through 1034 is one book. Numbers 10, 35, and 36 is a book. And from Numbers, from that point on is another book. So there are actually seven books of the Torah, according to this understanding. And so the Gemara continues, according to the whose opinion is it that which Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman said that Rabbi Yonatan said that regard the reverse, with wisdom she built her house, she carved its seven pillars, that these are the seven books of the Torah. So Numbers or Proverbs chapter 9 says that wisdom has carved out her seven pillars. Wisdom, of course, is none other than the Torah, so the Torah must have seven books. So it is according to the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, as by his count, there are seven books of the Torah: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, until and when the ark traveled, the portion and when the ark traveled, which is considered its own book, the remainder of Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Okay, which is interesting, right? Because now we have the five loaves and the two fish making a total of seven. So there might be some significance of that going on. I heard a Chabad rabbi talking about those two noons and how they're reversed and comparing them to fish. In order for a fish to be a living and kosher, it's got to swim upstream. That's why they're reversed. So there's is an existing concept. So, okay. Now, I don't know how deep we want to get into this, but remember how Joshua said that these to bring the people out and to bring the people in. And in the same way, these two verses talk about and when the ark went out and when the ark came in. And this can be compared to exile and redemption, leading the people out. So the first verse refers to exile and when the ark traveled. And the second verse refers then to redemption and when the ark rested. I mean, so another interesting fact in these two verses, if we count up the words in each of the verses, Vayehi binsoa ha'aron vayomer Moshe, Kuma Hashem v'yifutzu oyvecha v'yinusu misanecha mipanecha. First verse has 12 words. Okay? Second verse, Uvnucho yomar shuva Hashem rivavot alfe Yisrael kuma Hashem limnuchatecha. Wait, no, what is it? Oh, no, it's, let's see. I don't have it in front of me now. Oh, okay. No, the verse, actually, I went too far. Uvnu cho yamar, shuva Hashem, rivavot alfei Yisrael. That's the two verses. So that's the second verse actually only has seven. So the first one has 12, the second one has seven, and so happens that that those match the number of baskets in the first and the second feedings of the multitudes.
Can you remind me how in the conversation that we're having today, how we got to the yod, nun, vav, nun?
So that's in Psalm 72. Okay. Remember how it says, we know that the Messiah is supposed to bring all this abundance because it's all this bread, because it's the verse says, may there be abundance of grain in the land, on the tops of the mountains may it wave, may its fruit be like Lebanon, and may people blossom in the cities like grass of the field. And the very next verse says, and may his name endure, his fame continue as long as the sun. Okay? So that his name endure is Yod Nun Vav Nun. His name is Yunon.
Name is
Yod Nun Vav. Yeah.
Okay.
So it sounds like there's an intentional attempt to recreate the conditions of Psalm 72. And this Yunon aspect of it, the sheep without a shepherd, then is now connecting to Joshua.
Right.
And so we're mimicking the actions of Moses. And so this is the connections that's being made. That's a little bit of a stretch, but
but it really is how intricate and woven. You know, if Yeshua in John, and you know, in the Gospels, when they're telling that story, story about these loaves and fishes and connecting it to the Messianic verse of 72, and it may, his name be known forever with the two noons, and then tying that back to that book. That's amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm imagining now the 5,000 men all stationed in this grid.
Right. Oh, okay, now on the grid, 50 and 100.
Yeah.
Wow.
They're stationed like soldiers. I mean, they're seated.
Right.
But they're stationed like soldiers. And it's no wonder that Yeshua was worried that, oh, they're going to coronate me before long here.
Oh.
Right?
Oh.
This to me explains why we aren't counting the women and children. You don't count the women and children when you're taking a census for war.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So they're stationed in this military fashion. They're only counting the men, and Yeshua is concerned. So there's that the marching of the tribes. This is the banners and the flags and everything that the book of Numbers is talking about with the arrangement of the tribes. It's got a similar sort of effect going on here, where they're over the hill in formation like this. So I think that all might be pertinent. At any rate, I'm going to read to you a little bit about how Rashi interprets Psalm 72. He's just actually, it's not his interpretation, he's just gathering it from various sources. It says, may there be an abundance of grain, it says in Psalm 72:16. What it actually says in Hebrew is pisat bar. Pisat bar. The word bar is the word that it actually uses in the story of Joseph when the brothers go to buy grain. So one word for grain. There's several words for grain, but one of them is bar. Pisah is kind of a strange word, and the sages wrestle with this. Rashi, of course, he always wants to come up with the most natural, simple explanation. He says, pisah is an expression of spreading. It's like the word pisayon, of increase and abundance. Our sage, he can't leave out the what the sages say on this, though. So he says, our sages, however, explain this as an expression of loaves of white bread during the Messianic era. Now, if you look in his sources, the sages say that in the Messianic era, it's not going to be grain coming up out of the ground. It's going to be bread coming up out of the ground. They're going to be cakes of bread, literally, coming up out of the grass, out of the ground, in the Messianic era. Another explanation, he says, pisat is an expression of goodwill, like pius, like appeasement. The people are appeased and accepted by the Holy One, blessed is he, when he gives plenty in the world. So because you know how it is when people lack, there's fighting. And usually when there's a war, it's because somebody's trying to get something from someone else. So if everybody has plenty, maybe they won't be fighting so much. Taking one of these passages out of the Gemara. It says, Rabbi Chia Bar Yosef said, in the future, Eretz Israel will produce cakes, gluskaot, and fine wool clothing, milat, that will grow from the ground. As it says, let abundant grain be in the land, pisat bar be in the land. So pisat bar, another interpretation of pisat bar, is like Joseph's coat of many colors, which is called a ketonet pasim, and bar can mean bread. So they're imagining not just grain or loaves of bread coming out of the ground, but fully formed outfits being able to be plucked out of the ground as well.
Their goals are shopping.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I think that describes our shopping. Like, if you compare, I mean, in their time, if you wanted a new outfit, you made it.
Right.
Now, you want a new outfit, you just go to the store and you can just pick them off the shelves. It's remarkably simple. It might as well be just growing on the out of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, we're definitely seeing those are signs of the Messianic era that Yeshua is creating this abundance for people, and it's clear that however intricate we try to weave the web, it's clear that when they saw that occur, they knew that he was fulfilling the prophecies that everyone knew about, that come without cost and eat, that Isaiah refers to. Come, anyone who's thirsty, come to me and drink. And he says that regarding himself as well. So the people saw this. They knew it was a sign that the Messiah had come and that redemption was near, and that this was the man for the job. So that's really all I have to say, all I have to share. So may God let us see that time soon when the abundance really comes to not just to those of us who have means, but to everyone, the poor and needy as well.
Amen.